My name is Brady. I'm the campus pastor here, and we're kind of going panoramic tonight, which is kind of fun. And that last song, "Your Love Never Fails, It Never Gives Up." That's a really amazing thought. Don't you wish that when you got into a dating relationship that was the case, right? That as soon as you fall in love with the person, that you knew that their love would never fail, their love would never run out, their love would never give up. Wouldn't that be great? I mean, you have to go through all the games and you have to figure it out. You would just know for forever it would never give up, never fail, never run out. And you just have this great security, right? It's not really the way it is with dating relationships. We've been talking in this series about the relational journey that we get the opportunity to experience with Jesus. That the Christian life isn't this life that is lived separate from God. And this Christian life isn't this life that's a life of religion with a bunch of list of do's and don'ts on how we can get to God. What we believe in Christianity is that God actually came after us. That the God of the universe, who didn't need us, continually pursued after us even as we ran from him. It's the most epic love story of all time. The Christian life was meant to be lived alongside Jesus, an intimate relationship with Jesus, that we were supposed to actively pursue Jesus as he is actively pursued after us, as he is continuing to actively pursue after us. And last week we talked about kind of the feely side of it. We talked about the prostitute who washed Jesus' feet with her hair. We talked about Mary who sat at Jesus' feet and was just enthralled with his wisdom. We talked about Zacchaeus who kind of got rid of all the social, out of all the social bounds in order to do what it took to see Jesus, to experience Jesus because he wanted to be with Jesus. All three of these people, they forgot about social cues, they forgot about social norms, they didn't care about what anyone was thinking about them, they didn't care about what the consequences were because they were just preoccupied with Jesus. They just wanted to be with Jesus, they just wanted to listen to Jesus, to stare at Jesus, to just be near to Jesus. And that's awesome, I want that. We talked about how the Christian life, this relational journey with Jesus, should be characterized by us sometimes being preoccupied with Jesus. Like not having to force ourselves to think about Jesus, not having to force ourselves to pray, not having to force ourselves to read the Bible, but just sometimes go, I was thinking about Jesus, I didn't even know. I was preoccupied with who he is, with how good he is, with how beautiful he is. And I love that side of the relational journey. But when I think about relationships, especially in terms of human relationships, it's not always like that, right? I mean, you think about a dating relationship, as we were talking about earlier, is we don't have that security. And so this is basically how a dating relationship goes. And, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm rarely wrong. Why are you laughing? It's not funny. Basically, you see someone from afar. And maybe you see them, you hear them. And I'm not talking like physical distance. But you're not really close to them yet. But there's something about them that you like. Perhaps they're beautiful and you see the way that they look. And that produces a feeling in you that you like. Or perhaps they're really funny. And you like their personality. And when you're around their personality, it produces a feeling inside of you that you like. So you like the way that you feel when you're around this person. You like the way that you feel when you interact with this person. You like the way that you feel when you talk to this person. You love that feeling. And so what you do is you say, well, I want more of this feeling, so let's hang out more often. And so you start dating. And you hang out and you get to know this person more. And when you're together, you get this feeling and you love the feeling that you have when you're with this person. And you hold hands for the first time. It's like, oh, electricity. Love that feeling. Need some more of that. Right? You love the feeling that you get when you're around this person. And so you date until you don't get that feeling anymore. Or until it switches to a worse feeling, right? And then you break up. The interesting thing to me about dating is supposed to lead to marriage, right? I mean, that's kind of the purpose, is we're dating to figure out, you know, who we want to spend the rest of our life with. But dating is really more practice for a divorce than it is for marriage, right? Because in a marriage, you don't hang out until you don't get that feeling anymore, and then you're like, peace out, right? You don't do that. But that's what we do in our dating relationship. So it's not quite the same. Because sometimes the feeling is there, and sometimes the feeling isn't there. See also year two of my marriage. Yeah, I told you a few weeks ago that I was an epic failure as a husband year one. Epic failure as a husband year one. More than you can imagine. So you could imagine that in lieu of that, year two was probably going to be pretty rough. You know, because I didn't pursue after my wife's heart, because I didn't date my wife, because I didn't do what it took, I didn't have the feelings that I wanted to have, that I needed to have. And you could imagine the feelings that my wife had towards me after not being pursued for a year, right? Not great. Like, there were a lot of times when we didn't feel it. There were a lot of times when we felt it, but we felt the other thing. We felt the frustration, the negative feelings towards one another. Year two was rough. Have you guys ever experienced that with God? When, you know, maybe you turn to God in a moment of need and there's nothing there. You don't feel anything. It's like your words just echo into the vast emptiness of nothing. Or perhaps you're not excited about God at all, and you don't want to pursue after God. You don't want to love God. You don't want to seek after God. Have you ever experienced that in your relationship with God? Now, I have. I've experienced it a number of times in my relationship with God, in my walk, in my journey with Christ, none more than when my wife and I moved out to California. And if you've heard this story before, too bad. We moved out to California to follow my wife's dreams, to work at Disney, and that was awesome. And I just thought I was going to continue doing what I was doing. And so went out to California with that in mind. We got out to California, and the best way for me to describe it was God had other plans. I couldn't pursue the thing that I was doing before. And you know what? At that time, I had a great attitude about it. I really did. I was like, you know what, God? If that's not what you want for me, great. What do you want for me? I really do want to serve you. I really do want to seek after you. I want to be used in mighty ways for your kingdom. So what do you have for me? What are the passions that you've put in my heart? What are the gifts that you've given me, the abilities that you've given me? How do you want to use those for your glory? And through probably about a month of prayer and through having great conversations with really wise people, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to be a teaching pastor. Why anyone would ever want to be that, I don't know. That was really the last thing I ever would have wanted to be in life, period. First of all, I was a musician, and even as a musician, I didn't want to lead worship at a church because that's just Lecrae, okay? I mean, it's crazy. Because normally, and not here, I'm really blessed to be here, but normally people come to church because that's what you do. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what your parents did. You don't come to worship God. Easy, back off. And so, and you don't really come to worship God. So I was like, I don't want to lead worship at a church. I didn't want to work for a church, and I definitely didn't want to be a pastor, because that word, pastor, it's the worst. I mean, you're hanging out with some people, and then that question comes along. So, what do you do? Pastor, what? Oh, nothing. I'm unemployed, right? I mean, you'd rather say that than say pastor, because you know what's going to happen next. It's like conversation switch off. They're thinking through all their, you know, the words in their mind that they've used, the things that they've said. Dang it. Do I need to apologize? Oh, I said dang it. I thought dang it. Oh, no. What do I do? Mayday. So definitely didn't want to be a pastor, but nonetheless, that's what I felt God was calling me to be a teaching pastor. And so I thought, well, if God is calling me to be a teaching pastor, if this is where he's leading me, he's going to provide that for me. I wasn't worried. So I started applying for teaching pastor jobs. I didn't get any. And I thought, you know what? God's probably going to teach me a little humility, and that's okay. I'm okay with that. So I'll apply for any job at the church. I'll even apply for like a youth pastor job. So I applied for a number of different jobs at church, and I got none of them. And it started to weigh on me a little bit, but I thought, you know what? A little bit of humility, and that's okay. So I was like, I'll apply for some internships. So I applied for some internships. I didn't get any of those. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm getting a little frustrated, Lord. Ha, 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 you and me. But yeah, I'm seriously frustrated. So what's going on? And so I said, okay, I will apply for an unpaid internship. Now, mind you, I had a college degree from university, okay? I had 2 years of a seminary degree, and I had like my entire life of ministry experience. I was 31 years old, and I was applying for an unpaid internship at our church, and I didn't get it. Yeah. I was unhappy with God that day. We ended up moving to Florida about a month later, and when we kind of did that and kind of got a fresh start, I thought, maybe, perhaps, this was why. He wanted us to move to Florida, because if I'd gotten a job or an internship, we wouldn't have gotten able to do that. So great. But by this time, you know, we're running low on cash, and I needed to apply for any job. So I applied for everything. I applied for Best Buy. I applied for Apple. I applied for anything, churches, whatever, everything. And you know, weeks went by, and there was nothing. And I was at a really low point. As you can imagine, I was at a real high point with anger towards God. I was really unhappy with God. And I remember I dropped off Jennifer at the cast member parking at Epcot. And I was driving. I don't really know where I was driving. But I got to express with a louder tone my concern towards God. Some people call it yelling. I don't. When it's towards God. But I'm honestly, like, I was mad at God. God, what are you doing? Are you kidding me? And I expressed my feelings towards God, and I got nothing back. Nothing. It's like the words just went off into the vast space of nowhere. You know, in those times, in those moments, it's easy to feel alone. I don't know about you, but I didn't want to express any of these feelings with my community. Right? I didn't want to tell any of the people that I knew that I was angry with God. What would they think about me? What would they say? Would they try and fix me? I don't want to be fixed. I'm angry at God. He needs to be fixed. Right? I mean, that's what I was feeling. That's what I was thinking. I mean, I can't tell people because their relationship with God looks great. And they're getting to, you know, do all these great things. God is blessing their life. So I didn't want to approach community at this point. I felt very alone. Not just alone from God, but alone from people. And I began to think, well, this is me. There's a problem with me. What's going on? What's wrong with me? Am I the only person that's ever experienced this? And as I looked into the scriptures, I looked into the Bible, I got great comfort because there were a number of people, a number of great men and women that experienced the same thing. There's this guy named Job. And Job was known as the most righteous man on the planet. At the time, it's a pretty great thing to be known as. You would think God would be pretty excited about that, right? Well, Satan goes to God and says, hey, Job, he only loves you because you're blessing him. He only loves you because he's got wealth, because he's got to get a big family, because he's got lots of possessions, because he's got great health. And God says, well, I don't agree with you. And so Satan says, well, let's see. And so Satan proceeds to take everything from Job. He takes all of his possessions. He takes all of his cattle. He takes all of his livestock. He takes all of his family. He takes his health. And at this time, Job's a little bit frustrated, as you can imagine. And he's crying out to God. And he says this in Job chapter 30, verse 20. He says, I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. I cry to you for help, and you don't answer me. And I stand, you just look at me. Can you feel that? Can you understand what he's feeling right there at that moment? Have you experienced that? Job's not the only one. David. David was known as a man after God's own heart. David was the king of Israel whom God chose. And throughout the Psalms, David expresses this, but in Psalm chapter 10, verse 1, he says, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? God, I need you. Where are you? Why do you hide yourself when I need you?" There's a guy named Asaph. And Asaph was the choir director for all of Israel. And he wrote a number of the Psalms. And in Psalm 77, he wrote, "When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. Will the Lord spurn me forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in his anger shut up his compassion? Are his promises at an end for all time?" Isaiah, the prophet of the Lord, a man chosen by God to be God's mouthpiece, said this, "Truly you are a God who hides himself." While it's a little bit more comforting to know that I'm not alone in this, that I'm not the only one that has gone through this, that in fact, men much more righteous than I have gone through the same thing, it's a problem. Because if we were created to need to walk in intimate relationship with God, and if this is any indication of God's love for us or our love for God, then we're in trouble, right? I mean, if God's distance from us or our anger towards him is any indication of our feeling towards one another, then that's not a good thing if what we need is an intimate relationship with Jesus. So what do we do? And I love looking at these men and the things that they did. But typically what we do is we distract and numb ourselves because we don't want to feel these things. We don't want to experience these things. We don't want to sit alone in the muck and mire of these awful feelings. And so we distract ourselves with all kinds of things, with friends, with video games, with TV shows, entertainment, whatever. We just don't want to be there. But what should we do? What did these great men of faith do? Well, the first thing they did is they turned to God. And they didn't just turn to God, but they turned to God and they were honest with God. Which, first of all, at the moment, you don't want to turn to God. And second of all, makes me a little bit nervous to be honest with God when I'm having these feelings towards God, because we're supposed to fear God. I mean, he's a God of the universe, right? He doesn't need me, and he really, literally could strike me with lightning at any moment. And we're taught to respect God. So we can't be honest with God in these times, because the feelings that I'm having, the thoughts that I'm having, if I express those, something bad would happen. Something disastrous would happen, right? Well, newsflash, God knows everything. So he already knows what you're thinking. He already knows what you're feeling, right? He already knows that you think these things. He already knows that you feel these things. And God encourages us to turn to him in honesty, to be honest with God, just like Job was, just like David and Asaph, just like Isaiah. Turn to God and be honest. The second thing I see is that, especially with Job, is he turned to his community. He invited four buddies who he thought were wise, and he was open and honest with his community, which that is difficult in those times because it's one of those sinful areas that's a shaming, and you don't want to share with people. It's not like the gossip one. Yeah, I gossiped, and everyone's like, "Oh, yeah, me too. It's not good, but I can relate to that." But this is one of the ones that it just seems like no one can relate to. That no one's experienced like you're experiencing. Easy now. And I see Job, and he turned to his friends, and then he was honest with them. He came into community, and he said, "Hey, this is what's going on. This is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm thinking." And they spoke into his life. And the next thing I see, which I love, good old Asaph in Psalm 77, he said, "I will," and this is the same psalm where he was frustrated with God, okay? He said, I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I'll ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. With your arm, you redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. He said, your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. What Asaph does is he says, there is a vast amount of history of God interacting with the world, interacting with his people, with those whom he loved. I'm going to remember who God is, what God has done. And I love what he remembered. He went back to the time where they were in the Exodus, where the people of God were running from the armies of Pharaoh. And they were backed up against the Red Sea, and the armies were coming after them, and they were going to be slaughtered. And God parted the Red Sea. I mean, this amazing miracle, okay? He said, your way was through the sea. Now, just so you know, that's not the way I would have wanted to go. I mean, we can think about it, you know, good old Charlton Heston parting the Red Sea, if you guys remember that. And it looks pretty awesome, you know, in film, on the TV. But put yourself in the shoes of the Israelites or the sandals of the Israelites at the time. Could you imagine? Okay, you've never seen sea parted before. You don't know how long sea parts, right? There's a lot of wind. What if you're in the middle and then you drown, right? I wouldn't want to go through that way, but that was the way God was leading them. And Asaph says this, your way was through the sea, and yet your footprints were not seen. That in that moment, even though you were leading them through the sea, they couldn't see your footprints. There was a hint of you not being there. I mean, there was a hint of them wondering, are you really there? Are you really going to take care of us? Are you really going to save us? Are we really going to be making it all the way to the other side? And what Asaph does is he remembers, God, you did this in their lives and this and that and that. And in all the different people throughout history that you have loved, they have also experienced these times where you have been distant. They've also experienced these times where they have been angry and frustrated with you. He remembers God. And the accumulation of all this is that we, when we experience this, is that we are supposed to do what we don't feel like doing. Now, I don't know how many of you are let down with that. I'm a little let down with that, right? I mean, first hearing, that doesn't sound so great, that the answer is to do what we don't feel like doing, because that's the problem. I don't feel like doing it. I don't want to turn to God. I'm angry. I feel angry. I don't feel loving. I don't feel respectful. So what do you mean, do what I don't feel like doing? And it's so interesting in our society and the culture that we have been grown up in, the things that we've learned from our society, is we hold up this idea of love of the heart, you know, the love of the fluttering, the love of the feelings and the Twitter-patedness, right? I mean, this is the love that we prize, that we hold up in our society, in our entertainment, and what we do is we downplay the love of the will. You know, we see this throughout entertainment. Think about the great book that, you know, all of us guys have read, Dear John. You know, and the movie that they made after that. You know, in good old Dear John, there's a girl and there's a Channing Tatum. And what happens is this girl, of course, falls in love with Channing Tatum. Who wouldn't? And, you know, he's this nice guy, and he's good looking, and he's in the army, because Nicholas Sparks is a guy of someone in the army in all of his books. And so you've got this guy and the girl, and they fall in love. And then he's got to go off to war for his country. And he goes off, and he goes, and he stays in a number of different tours. And then she writes in this Dear John letter, you know, that, hey, you know, we're not going to be together anymore. FYI. When you get back, it's, you know, not going to be the same. And so he ends up you know, staying over in Iraq for a while, and then he comes home, or Afghanistan, one of the two. And then he comes home, and she's married to another guy. But the thing is this guy that she's married to, she doesn't love him like he loved her, like she loved Channing, right? They don't have that same connection. And Channing comes, and you know, there's these, you know, these moments. And what we all do in the audience, we all want her to be with Channing Tatum. We want her to be with the guy that she loves, that she has these feelings for, that she's experienced. Like, we're all crying out for that. And there was a movie and a book, once again, The Bridges of Madison County. There's this woman, she's married to this man, she's got a couple kids, and they go out of town for a while, and then another guy comes into town, and they kind of fall in love and have this affair. And at the end of the movie, at the end of the book, you're hoping that the wife leaves the husband and leaves the kid for this man that she's deeply and desperately in love with. Like, I mean, that's what you want at the end of it. You hope for that. I mean, there's so many different examples of this. Crazy Stupid Love, The Notebook, okay? You've got this girl who's engaged to this guy, and then you've got a Ryan Gosling, right? And she's in love with the Ryan Gosling, of course. Who wouldn't be? Max South, you know what I'm talking about. Our local Ryan Gosling. And what do we all want? I mean, they're in the boat, rowing the boat, and it starts to rain, and then they're talking, and they're yelling at each other, and they're like, kiss, 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 and continue. But she's engaged to another dude. Right? Well, none of us thinks twice about that guy, that poor lonely fellow that's engaged to her, that she's committed to. We want her to be with Ryan. That's what we want. Right? I mean, you guys remember a movie that came out very recently in a place where it got really, really cold? Yeah, Frozen. And there was the happy dude, Olaf, right? And everything. And there's this song called Let It Go. And I just want to read you a couple lines from this song. There's this girl who's got this power. And in her entire life, the power, she's had to conceal it. She's had to hide it. She's had to keep it in. She's had to use her will over her feelings, over, you know, her emotions about this. And all of a sudden, she gets free and she sings a song, Let It Go, which, you know, goes well. He says, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you always have to be. That was kind of the way it was. You know, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you've always had to be. Now, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know, right? I mean, you can kind of feel what she's feeling. You're like, no, you should be able to express it. You should be able to let it out. And then she goes into the chorus, let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Something about slamming a door. She goes into this, in the second verse, and the last line of the second verse says, no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Now that I'm finally able to express what I feel, I'm free. Now that there's no rules, no right, no wrong, I'm free. And we're all like free with her, yeah? We're like, yeah, be free, have powers, free Willy. I mean, we're like free. That's what we want. That we're right there with her. And in all of these movies, what it does is it reveals our heart. Because we are saying, no, you shouldn't have to be with the people that you commit to be with. You should get to be with the people that you love, that you care about. That's what you should get to do. Everyone should get to be in love and be with that person. Let's look at this scenario. Let's pretend perhaps that it's my anniversary, which is coming up really soon. If you got any great ideas, I would love those. January 27th. Comes along, and I leave my house just to come back and knock on the door to pick up my wife. And I've got a couple dozen roses, you know, just there for her. And she opens the door. She's elated, you know, smiling. Give her the roses. And I take her out to her favorite sushi restaurant. And I say, you know what? Order as many rolls as you want. I don't mind. You know what? We don't even have to split dessert tonight. Go for it. The world is your oyster. Or, you know, raw fish. And And we do that. And then let's say at the end of the night, I pull out this little bitty box. And little boxes are good on dates, right? Because little boxes signify sparkly things that are really expensive, right? And so I pull out this little box with the sparkly expensive thing, and I give it to her. And after, you know, after this great date, she looks at me and she's like, "Oh, thank you so much. It's so amazing to get to be with a guy that loves me and cares about me and wants to spend time with me and wants to do these things for me." Now, what if perhaps I responded in this way? "Actually, sweetheart, I didn't want to go out tonight. It was the Super Bowl. I really would have rather watched the Super Bowl. But because I know that you like going out, especially on our anniversary, I said, you know, let's do that." And what if I said, "Yeah, and you know, buying you stuff like that, those flowers, you know, flowers, just so you know, they die in just a week or two. Even if you put the special packet of stuff in the water, right? I mean, it doesn't save them for forever. It's basically a waste of money. But I know that you like flowers, so I did that. And let's not even start talking about how much money we wasted on the sparkly things that you won't even wear every day, you know, right? But I know that means something to you, so I got it." Anyone think that would be a good idea to respond that way? Anyone? Anyone here? None of us. None of us, because that's not what we want. We want someone who says, "I gave this to you because I felt like it." Perfect timing. Thanks, Mark. "I gave these to you because I felt like it. I took you out and I forsook the Super Bowl because I felt like it," right? "And I gave you the sparkly thing. I didn't even know there was a price tag on it because I felt like it." That's what we want. But let's look at these two different examples. Okay, when it's because I felt like it, I bought these flowers for you because I like the feeling that I get when I buy flowers for you, and I like the feeling that I get when I give them to you and I see that look on your face. It produces a feeling in me that I really like. Okay, real quick, completely unselfish? Or is there some selfish in there? Correct answer, selfish. Okay, right? Now, I took you out to dinner, especially on the Super Bowl night, because I know you're going to appreciate that. And if you appreciate that, then later, some other day, you may do something for me like that. You may sacrifice something for me, right? Any selfish motivation there? Right? Here's the thing. The love of feeling is a smaller, more selfish love. That's just true. Because if it's the feeling, if it's because I like the feeling that I get, it's selfish. Because what happens when the feeling goes away, when the feeling's not there? I tell you, a more epic love, a more noble love is this. I promise you that I will love you for the rest of your life. I will serve you. I will die for you in sickness and health, in good times and bad times, in richer or poorer, when you're young, when you're old, when you act loving towards me, when you don't act loving towards me, when I feel it, when I don't feel it, it doesn't matter. I will take care of you. I will love you. I will treat you right forever. You know, so often we get on these two polar opposite sides. It's like the love of feeling versus the love of the will. And I think it's dumb. I mean, some people say feelings are everything. They're not. I mean, feelings can be very, very deceptive. But I believe that if you do love of the will correctly, that the feelings will accompany it sometimes. But the good thing is the feelings won't direct it. Because feelings come and go. They're not always there. Every relationship you experience this, with humans, with God, the feelings come and go. But what's amazing, it's a gift from God that sometimes we feel distant from him. Because we get the opportunity to participate in a much more noble, a much more epic, a much deeper, secure, lasting love. That we can say, it doesn't matter whether I feel it or not, I choose to love you and pursue after you because you have continually pursued after me. The movies that we like are the epic movies. I keep going back to Lord of the Rings in my mind for some reason. But it's a story about these little bitty hobbits. They're like half people, I mean, in height-wise. And that's a good thing, Huli. I got in trouble last week when I said something about short people. I wasn't making fun of short people. Anyway, hobbits, okay? Hobbits are these people. They're kind of, not because they're short, but in the movie, they're kind of insignificant, okay? So you've got these little... not humans, hobbits, that are kind of insignificant, and yet they play this gigantic role in the course of the history of Middle Earth. And you know what is so amazing about that movie? It's what they have to go through is just so hard and so difficult. It wrenches your emotions because they're struggling and they're suffering, and some people died, some people didn't make it. But it's epic. Like, these are the type of movies that people dress up at midnight to go see, right? I mean, it's the same thing with Harry Potter. I mean, it's this epic type of movie that's difficult, and you're going for the little guy. Here's the thing, the love that we get to experience with God because sometimes we feel that he's not there is this epic love, the love that people want to write about, the love that people want to talk about, these stories that are epic. We get the opportunity to participate actively in that love because there are times when we don't feel God. And what's even cooler than that, and maybe not cooler than that, but just kind of like the icing on the cake is this. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters. And what this book is, the book isn't the icing on the cake, just so you know. The book is this series of letters that this general in the devil's army, the enemy's army, is writing to his nephew who's like a private in the army. And he says this. He says, Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Which Wormwood is that? The private, the guy, the demon guy. He says, don't be deceived, Wormwood. Our case is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy, which is God, to do God's will, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of God seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. There's something unique about this opportunity that we get, not just to participate in this epic love, but also there is a unique uniting to Jesus because Jesus went through this. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, Father, take this cup from me. Jesus on the cross, when he takes the sins of the world, all of our sins, all the things that we've done that are awful, things that no one knows about, he took them upon himself. And in that moment, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because in that moment, the Father turned his face away because the Father can't be in the presence of sin. And he cries out, why have you forsaken me? What C.S. Lewis wrote is true, because in that moment, when it seemed like every trace of God was gone, in that moment when Jesus still chose to do the will of the Father, he defeated death itself. And we get the most amazing opportunity to be uniquely united to Jesus in that moment. In a special way, when we feel distant from God, when we don't feel close to God, when we feel frustrated with God, we get to experience something unique that Jesus experienced that unites us nearly to him. We get the most amazing opportunity in the world to live a life that is characterized by this relational journey with Jesus, that we can experience intimacy with the God of the universe, that we can be preoccupied with him, that we can sometimes just accidentally be thinking about him, that we can have these awesome feelings when we sing these worship songs that make us want to raise our hands and just shout out his praise. And it's not a relationship that's determined by how we feel, that it's still steadfast and it's still secure even when we don't feel it. Because God is still there, allowing us to participate uniquely in this amazing, epic love. Love of the heart, love of the feeling, and love of the will united. This is the relational journey that we get to walk alongside Jesus for the rest of our lives in. How amazing is our God? Your love never fails. It never gives up. It never runs out on me. His love never fails. Never. Not even when you can't feel it. Not even when you've sinned. Not even when you've committed just a heinous act of sin. It never fails. It never gives up. It never runs out on me. His love never fails. It never gives up. It never runs out on me, and it will never run out on you. That's the God that we love and serve. Heavenly Father, God, I'm blown away at the thought that your love never fails. It never gives up. It never runs out on me. God, because it should run out on me. When I don't pursue you, when I run away from you, God, when I've been angry with you, it should have run out on me. Thank you, Jesus, that it doesn't. Thank you that you paid the ultimate price for my sins. Not just the ones that I've committed in the past, but the ones now and the ones in the future that you have paid for them. And that I can, because of your great love, because of your pursuit, I can experience an intimate relationship with you every day of my life. Thank you. Help me to feel near to you though, Lord. Lord, bless us with those times of just enriching joy and nearness to you. And yet help us to be steadfast and secure even when we don't. So that we can participate in the most epic love ever dreamed up. And it's in your amazing name, Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen.